Welcome to No Filter. I'm your host, Anna Kasparian, and I'm super excited for today's program. We're gonna have a wonderful discussion with Dr. Adolph Reed Jr. He is an author and professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, and I highly recommend you look into his essays and read his books because he tackles the topic of identity politics in a way that I think is actually very productive and necessary. Well before identity politics or the notion of identity politics was hijacked by the alt-right for their own political agenda, there was actual academic work in this regard. And Dr. Reed, thank you so much for joining us because I really do look forward to talking about this with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm a huge fan, so I'm glad to have the opportunity.
So I learned of your work through a good friend of mine, Michael Brooks. He sent me some of your essays and I was very impressed. And he recently interviewed you on his own show, The Michael Brooks Show.
Right.
So everyone should check out that conversation as well. But I wanna get right into it. So let's talk a little bit about what identity politics means to you and how it's impacted politics to the neoliberal agenda.
Well, okay. What identity politics means to me, I guess, is a focus on inequalities or injustices that have to that are based on what one supposedly is rather than what one does, right? Based on assigned or ascribed identities like race, gender, age, I suppose, could be one or whatever, and it's not. That notion of identity politics becomes significant or marked in contrast to a notion of equal justice or the fight for social justice that's anchored more to concerns about economic inequality.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is fascinating is, you know, if you take a look at the past elections, you know, in modern times, you notice that the Democratic Party really differentiates itself from the Republican Party by hyper focusing on identity issues. So they'll talk about how, you know, as a Democratic candidate, this individual is better suited to protect gay rights. That's one of the more recent examples, or to do something about inequality among the races in America. But in reality, there's a far larger issue that really connects all of us, and that's the issue of economic justice. So do you see this as a way of kind of distracting from what neoliberalism actually wants to accomplish?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd put it slightly differently, but not much. I mean, I think, because for the longest time, I tried to work with a formulation, I mean, like that, right? And tried to navigate my way through, the race class dichotomy, as it used to be called. And it finally occurred to me that the race versus class or identity politics versus class formulation is actually wrong. That because there's no politics in a class society, it's not a class politics. And so what the distinction is between what's typically understood as identity politics and what's typically understood as class, with the working class silent as a working class politics, is that they are both reflective of class politics, just of different classes. That is to say, what's thought of as identity politics at this point, that is a condition in which the most meaningful grievances or injustices are those that have to do with disparities between groups, right? Between blacks and whites, men and women, blacks and women, whatever, produces a world as an ideal of justice, right? That perspective produces a world in which the society could be considered just if 1% of the population owned or controlled 90% of the good stuff in the society, so long as that 1% were itself 12% black, half female, 14% Latino, whatever appropriate percentages, gay or trans or whatever. And that is not only a notion of justice that's compatible with neoliberalism. It's I think we can say at this point concretely that it's the neoliberal understanding of what a just society is. That is to say, that notion of where the greatest injustices are, or the injustices that need to be given priority for mediation, is a notion that's completely consistent with the neoliberal view of the world, in which inequalities created through the market are not problematic at all, but are just and correct. And in recent years, I've taken to pointing out that where this leaves us, actually, is that we have two political alternatives in the mainstream of American life that are equally committed to a neoliberal agenda. Sorry, I forgot to turn that off. To a neoliberal agenda, but one is also doctrinally committed to the principles of diversity, and the other is doctrinally opposed to the principles of diversity. Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, if those are the only choices that we have, well, then obviously the one that's committed to a horribly unequal world except for diversity is like less bad kind of than the other one. But for most of us, the reasonable expectation would be to demand some other choices. Because it's also worth pointing out in this regard that, you know, most Black Americans, most Latinos, most women, most gay and trans people fall outside that 1% or to 20% of the population. Mm-hmm. And would actually and actually are much more concerned about stuff like Medicare for all, access to higher ed, to housing, and so forth and so on, than they are likely to see themselves or to see as a success that Ava DuVernay gets more the Oscars than she got last time or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I want to go to an interview that you did with Bill Moyers back in 2014. Mm-hmm. And it was in regard to a piece that you wrote in Harper's titled "Nothing Left: The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals." We have two clips from that interview. I want to go to the first one, where you kind of discuss neoliberalism in more detail and what it means when you say that America's liberals have surrendered. Take a look.
But you know, Democrats won four of the last six presidential elections. Something's working for them.
What exactly have we gotten out of the fact that they've won?
Well, winning is not enough, you're saying.
No, here's an illustration of the limits of it. President Obama, in the speech he gave a couple of weeks ago, the ballyhooed speech where he mentioned the word inequality a couple of times, he leaves the podium in effect and goes straight to try to strong arm his own party to support fast track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
So, what we've got is like a bipartisan neoliberalism, right? That's a center of gravity of the American government. And to be clear, what I mean by neoliberalism is that it's two things. It's a free market utopian ideology, and it's a concrete program for intensified upward redistribution. And when the two objectives conflict, guess which one gets put on the shelf. But both parties are fundamentally committed to this. And at this point, and I think we've seen this much more clearly since the 2008 election, the principal difference between Democrats and Republicans is a choice between a neoliberal party that is progressive on multicultural and diversity issues, and a neoliberal party that's reactionary and horrible on those same issues. But where the vast majority of Americans live our lives and feel our anxieties about present and future and insecurity is not about the multicultural issues over which there's so much fight, but in the very realm of neoliberal economic issues to which both parties are in fact committed.
Dr. Reed, I feel like that interview was really foreshadowing the nightmare of an administration we're dealing with today, because my take is, you know, because of the fact that we were dealing with two parties that were essentially the same when it came to their economic policies, people were so frustrated that they were willing to just destroy everything and maybe go for someone who's a bit of a wild card, who's, you know, Donald Trump. Now, of course, he ended up not being a wild card. He's more of the same when it comes to right-wing politicians. But do you see anyone, you know, in Washington today that offers anything different? Someone that would break this paradigm that we've been dealing with, this neoliberal paradigm in America?
Yeah, sure, that's easy. The best shot for that, the only shot for that is Bernie Sanders. I mean, because Sanders has understood this all along, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I found so frustrating about the whole line that, you know, Bernie Sanders can't address Black Americans' concerns. I mean, I worked in a Sanders campaign last time as well, and you know, every now and then somebody not just Black people, but particularly African Americans would ask me what Bernie's thing is, why he doesn't seem concerned about Black American issues. And my response to that was always the same, and still is, which is just to go down the items in the Sanders platform and then ask, so in what way is this not is Medicare for All not primarily an African American or Latino issue? In what way is a $15 an hour minimum wage not an African American or Latino issue, and so forth and so on? And the interesting thing is, and I don't think this is a matter of my being wishful, I guess, but I don't recall one working person who asked me that question who didn't respond to my response by saying, "Yeah, I see that. It makes sense." Mm-hmm. Now, people in the PMC, in the professional and managerial strata, it was a slightly different story because their issues aren't the issues that most working people are concerned about. Mm-hmm. And I was just at a at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia at a panel this past week, and one of my colleagues and friends pointed out that this idea that some more or less articulate individual has the key to expressing what the Black American agenda looks like, when you consider that the Black American population is larger than the population of Canada, is a really bizarre, crazy, simplistic, and frankly even condescending view that there can be some special Black agenda that somebody else can speak ex cathedra about. But again, I mean, that also underscores the extent to which this identity politics or this race politics is in fact fundamentally a class politics itself.
So
but politics of a different class.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I actually want to talk a little more about that because I think that it's tricky to message that to groups of people in America who have been dealing with things as significant as police brutality, discrimination when it comes to something like home loans, for instance. And so I want to talk about how you can mitigate that and how you can effectively message some of the academic work that you've put forth when it comes to identity politics versus neoliberalism. So we'll be back after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to No Filter. I'm Anna Kasparian, and we're here with Dr. Adolph Reed. We're discussing identity politics and neoliberalism. So, Dr. Reed, you had written that wonderful piece in Harper's back in 2014, and that was immediately followed with an interview with Bill Moyers. And there was one other portion of that interview that I wanted to share with the audience and then kind of discuss that in today's terms. So let's take a quick look.
The way politics has evolved since the 1980s is that what we get now is the symbolic victory for the single person instead of the redistributive agenda. And the fact of the matter is, if you take a simple numerical standard, since the majority of Black Americans are working class, the majority of the country, and since Black Americans are disproportionately part of the working class, than a redistributive program that secures and advances the interests of working class people will disproportionately benefit black people.
Dr. Reed, I think that's such an incredible point. And it's not an easy point to make, I'm gonna be honest, as a blonde white woman who does this show. Because oftentimes, you know, as someone who has been very supportive of Bernie Sanders as a candidate, oftentimes when I'm confronted with questions of how he would deal with race relations in America, I don't know how to effectively message that the very issues that he's running on in his campaign would not only benefit the African American community or the Latino community in America, it really benefits the working class overall, which is a very diverse class of people who have been victimized by neoliberal policies. So how do we message that when, you know, you also have to keep in mind, police brutality does disproportionately impact African Americans in America?
Well, it does, but see, I think there's part of a problem with that construct too, and we actually talked about this on the panel, that it disproportionately affects black Americans, but it also disproportionately affects different black Americans in different ways, and it also affects non-black people, right? So even police killing, for instance, which is the most dramatic and the most obvious, but actually, you know, police kill more white people than they kill black people. And yeah, I mean, this is where the disparities thing plays out, because it's true that black people are killed at a higher level or are brutalized by police at a relatively greater level per capita than whites are. But whites are also shot and killed by police. And in fact, the states in which police killings have the highest incidence per capita population have in fact been in states where there are practically no black people, like Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming. So to be clear, I guess, because I think I kind of stumbled through that white people are killed at a higher rate than black people in the overall population in those states in which there are no black people around, right? But that's also true about other cases and concerns as well. For instance, as a standard narrative about the New Deal having been racist because blacks were excluded at relatively higher rates, considerably higher rates from Social Security and participation like in other New Deal programs than against whites. But then when you look at the reality, 65% of black Americans who were excluded from coverage by Social Security, but then it turns out at the same time that 3/4 of people who were excluded from Social Security were in fact white. Mm-hmm. So the point is that it's not just quite so simple as blacks suffering and whites being excluded. And moreover, I mean, just to stick with the criminal justice stuff. Mm-hmm. While black Wall Street minions, right, rich black people, I'm certain are substantially more likely to be arrested or beaten up or shot and killed by police than their white peers, mm-hmm. right? But it's also the case that that upper status white black people are substantially less likely to be beaten down, shot, killed, arrested by police.
So you're saying that socioeconomic status is a better indicator of discriminatory practices?
Right. Yeah. Ultimately. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would say that racial status is part of the story, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that reducing to the story as as blacks being discriminated against or abusive or rather abused without taking into account of intra-racial difference is not only missing the source of the dynamic, but it also I think underscores the extent the class character of the race first line, or what my son describes as a race reductionism. So I mean, I don't know if that was like too vague or
no. I totally understand what you're saying. Okay. I do think though that the American electorate has been conditioned for decades now,
right,
probably since the late 1940s, to be hyper focused on
right
justice in regard to race, gender, decades later, sexual orientation. And it's kind of difficult to get people to understand that really the underlying factor to all of this stuff is this class warfare, but against the
right
worker,
And yeah, so, pretty much.
Yeah. And so I appreciate the work that you do, because, I've fallen into that, fallen victim to that narrative for a long time. And it really took a moment for me to kind of step back and understand, like, hey, you know what? There is this one thing that unites all of us as workers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
right
the fact that these neoliberal policies have truly worked against us. And now we're in this late stage capitalism where people are starting to wake up, and hopefully they're discovering some of the work that you've done. Dr. Adolph Reed, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I really appreciate
okay
you taking the time to have this conversation.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks much. I'm happy to be on.
Welcome back to No Filter. I just wanted to give you guys a quick announcement before we wrap up this episode of the show. The Young Turks are in a bit of a transition phase right now. The CEO of the company and my colleague Cenk Uygur will be running for Congress. And as a result, he has handed off all editorial control of the Young Turks main show to me, which means that I have a lot more on my plate in addition to election coverage, which is of course gonna take up quite a bit of my time. I'm telling you all this because as a result, we will be putting this podcast, this program on hiatus, and hopefully after the election, we'll have a better idea of whether the show will come back. But I do appreciate everyone who's watched and supported this show. I really do love putting this show together for you every week. This was something that I cared quite a bit about. But unfortunately, I'm being pulled in so many different directions that I need to take some stuff off my plate so I can focus. So again, thank you. We'll have a better idea of whether No Filter will be coming back after the elections. And in the meantime, remember, as I always say, never be afraid to speak your truth with No Filter.